HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ.
This episode is brought to you by Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks.
Immigrants from all over the world have settled across the American Midwest, so it's easy to focus on the influence of immigrant communities on developing regional foodways. But what about the impact of domestic migration on Midwestern food? On today's show, this is exactly the question we intend to explore. Specifically, we are taking a look at two groups that in some instances actually intersect: African Americans and those migrating from Appalachia into the Midwest. When and why did these communities come here? And what food did they bring with them? Well, we're about to find out here on this episode of Eat Your Heartland Out with me, your host and tour guide, Capri Cafaro. To discuss how African Americans have changed the Midwestern food landscape, I'm joined by Donna Pierce. Donna is the author of the syndicated column, Black America Cooks, was the assistant food editor for the Chicago Tribune, and is currently writing a book on Frida DeKnight, the first food editor of Ebony Magazine. Donna, I'm so excited to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you have so much personal knowledge, so much expertise, and so I want to just start off with maybe you giving our listeners, if you can, a brief overview of the timeline of African-American migration into the Midwest. When did they come? Why did they come? I know that's a big question. And where did they come from in the different regions of the country?
Right. Well, there was, it's an amazing, the whole migration story, and it's often referred to as the Great Migration, but the migration itself, there were early migrations to out of the South to California, splitting between San Francisco and Los Angeles. Back in the 4,000 African Americans between 1850 and 1860. And then there was Kansas. I grew up in Missouri, and Kansas allowed homesteading, was a free state, in the 1870s and 1890s. And there were probably 30,000 Blacks who came to homestead in Kansas. And then in Oklahoma also had homesteading. But at the turn of the century, there were And I'm referring to Many Rivers to Cross, Dr. Gates, Dr. Henry Louis Gates. There were 9 million African Americans in the United States at the turn of the century, and 7 million lived in the South. And dividing the migration between the two periods, there was the early period that's said to be the rural people escaping rural South, 1916 to about 1930. And then there was the second phase, and that was 1940 to 1970. And during that period, 6 million left the South. I was part of it. My family left in 1950, and my sisters and I were born in the 50s in Missouri, and so we were first generation born as Great Migration generation.
Well, and so I know that you have this personal story. Your family has roots in Alabama, Louisiana, and you came to
Columbia, Missouri, if I'm not mistaken, as you just mentioned. And why did your family choose the Midwest? Why did they choose Missouri? And what kind of traditions, food traditions in particular, did they bring with them?
You know, it's interesting. I look, my family came 5 generations from Mobile, Alabama, the Gulf Coast, and New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And right, if you look at the map, and I have it on my website, so people who really want to see that trans, you can kind of see where people came from that part, went up the middle of the country, and it's like a direct route. You could go up to Chicago, Missouri, and you see the branching off. Mm-hmm. My parents were 5 generations of college graduates, but they decided they didn't want to raise their children in the segregated South. And my right. dad looked any, he looked for the furthest north where he would be hired. He was a Tuskegee graduate, and he looked for furthest north, and that was Poplar Bluff, Missouri. And my son teases me because it's this little town very close to the Boot Heel, which is where the little kick boot of Missouri kicks into Arkansas. So mm-hmm. very close to Memphis, very close to Arkansas, but it was Missouri. And my dad accepted that job, married my mother. My mother had gone to Fisk, where her father and grandfather had gone to Meharry. She had gone to Fisk and then transferred when her father died to Florida A&M. And she had just graduated, and they got married and moved right then to Poplar Bluff, Missouri. And they were there for 2 years and then moved to Dalton, Missouri, which is northern near Iowa, north of Kansas City, where dad was the last principal of a black high school. And when that closed, they moved to Columbia, Missouri.
Right. And so, you know, what I'm hearing you talk about is, you know, a history of two things. One is a family that is, you know, middle class, college educated, a story that we don't often hear about, you know, the middle class, the rise of the middle class of African Americans across the country, and that desire to leave the segregated South for a place that would have better opportunity. And in this case for you, it would be Missouri. But, you know, I'm also hearing, you know, that this story of it's a mid 20th century story, one that we don't necessarily hear a lot about as well. We do hear about it in the context of segregation, but I can say from my own personal experience in Ohio, so much of our sort of, when we look at African American migration, it is very, focused on, the escape of slaves, around the Civil War period and the Underground Railroad from Cincinnati all the way up to Lake Erie to the, you know, to escape to Canada. And so we're very focused on that in Ohio. But, you know, I'm curious to focus this back a little bit more on food, because that's what we're talking about here, is when you bring these different food ways, you're talking about, you know, a migration from the South into the Midwest. What kind of traditions did your family bring from the Gulf Coast into a place like Missouri, which may not have had the same things on hand?
Right, my grandmother used to joke, who's remained in Missouri, who would come and live with us for a school year or whatever to help my mother and father take care of the kids. But she would say that we were growing up Southern in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And they insisted that we appreciate the dishes that were our collective dishes from the Gulf Coast. And for our family, that was gumbo, and that was red beans and rice, and that was really delicious seafood dishes that were very difficult to get in sure. landlocked Missouri. We ate catfish, and some of the recipes that maybe they would have used for red snapper or other white fish, my mother used catfish to make that. And mm-hmm. But otherwise, it was very difficult. Now, on the other hand, my mother and father had never had chili con carne. And when I went to grade school, to elementary school, we came home and asked, and my mother learned to make it for us. And the way it was served in my school cafeteria, it was served with peanut butter sandwiches. That was the menu, which a lot of people haven't heard that combination. And so my mother made it with peanut butter sandwiches because that's what we taught her, because it was an exchange. We were teaching her Midwestern food, and they were insisting that we learn the Southern food. And so to this day, you know, that's the dish that we have peanut butter when we make chili at home.
So how did your family get things like shrimp up to Missouri? I remember you telling me a story that I'd love you to share with our listeners, which I think is really, really interesting.
When my elegant little grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was, when she died, she was the last living Spelman graduate, and she would come up in suits. She and my grandfather would be fully dressed on the train ride from Mobile to St. Louis, and then we would pick them up in St. Louis and drive to Columbia. But when they would come up, they would bring an ice chest, sometimes two ice chests. They would replace some of the luggage with an ice chest filled with Gulf shrimp and oysters and red snapper and all of the dishes that my parents were just missed so much from their upbringing. So I can remember now, I can still see myself as a little girl, how excited my parents were to have this, you know, pull out of the ice and see real shrimp. That was delicious.
I could imagine how excited they would be, because, you know, food, and that's why I love having conversations like this, because it reminds us that food is so much more than just nourishment. It's nourishment for the soul, right? It is a way in which people connect to their past. They pass that on to the next generation. And that story, I think, is just such an incredible snapshot of a time and a place and the role of food in America at that time. I want to ask you a little bit. You know, your story is very much an interesting vignette of, you know, sort of the larger history of African American migration into the Midwest. But when we think, and again, I'm looking at this through kind of my little corner of the Midwest, which is a little bit more industrial. But, you know, we see, you know, African Americans settling in urban communities like a Cleveland or Detroit or Chicago, but also in more rural areas as well. Could you tell us a little bit about how food may differ, if it does, between African Americans that may have settled in an urban center in the Midwest versus a more rural community throughout the Midwest?
Well, there are a couple of things there. You know, one of them is that what you're speaking of and what you learned about and what you saw in school or in your textbooks or in the kind of the advertising, things that were omitted or edited from what was taught about Black people. In my textbooks, I didn't see these kinds of things that were the middle class Blacks. 10% of the population was middle class, who had a different, who perhaps had a, you know, the different background in terms of menus and whatever. So there was one story that was pretty much told during that time period in all of the textbooks. There was nothing on television. You know, there were no Black people on television that time. So there was the one lady who would kick in the Jackie Gleason show, and she was one of the dancers. And that was the only Black person. We would all gather to watch and try to pick her out among the dancers. But so the dishes that we were able, for one thing, it depended on what region that you went to. And we visited my cousins in Chicago, at a big, big family in Chicago at that time, which is probably why I think I continued my migration to come to Chicago, but we would come to visit. And the dishes were traditionally all over the Midwest, Southern dishes that people were adapting based on what was available. I'm a big cookbook collector, and I collect the community cookbooks of the time.
I love community cookbooks. They tell such a good story.
Yeah, they really do. They tell the story of somebody was describing it as stirring the family memory and loss into recipes. And wow. And that's really, you know, a community cookbook. So, for instance, I have there were big community cookbooks of Blacks, of African Americans who had migrated in Montana, making dishes that were Southern dishes, making, dishes that we talk about, greens, macaroni and cheese, sweet potatoes, fried chicken, dishes that were brought from a collective kind of recipe memory, and mm-hmm. bringing those to wherever they would go. And a lot of almost any place that you would go where there was an African-American population, these dishes survived because that's how they were brought up. These Southern recipes were brought up to the Midwest from formerly enslaved who came north.
Right. And can you give an example maybe of how one of those dishes could have been adapted to Midwest, because maybe there's not a specific ingredient that could be available, and they managed to adapt these Southern food ways to Midwestern resources.
Right. And also with ingredients that were available.
Yeah.
For instance, hot sauce. It was very difficult to find. And the only one that most people could find, a lot of people could find, especially in smaller Midwestern communities, was Tabasco. And that's mm-hmm. not a hot sauce that African-American people appreciate. There's some racism involved with it, but there's also, there are a lot of other ones that are people had grown up with. But everybody had Tabasco because that's what was available. And it's the same with grits. It's the same with sausages. The smoked sausages that we used to have, my grandmother made in Mobile. It was, and it wasn't andouille. That was not the Gulf Coast sausage they used. It was a smoked sausage that was handmade along the Gulf Coast that tasted more like smoked chorizo from Spain.
Oh.
And in fact, when I replace it now, I use the smoked chorizo instead of the andouille or anything, because it's the most flavorful. It tastes the same texture, the same flavor and whatever. But we used to have to use any kind of sausage we could find. If we were lucky enough to find Italian sausage, great. If not, but any sausage would do. And so my mother would use that. My mother, I remember the saddest looking shrimp that my mother would buy at the AMP for shrimp Creole, you know, and then the canned beans that she would buy, or the dried beans that she would bring up when they would go down to visit. And then they would use that and share it with each other. Whenever mm-hmm. anybody went on a trip south, the trunk would come back filled with, you know, the dried beans and filled with spices, filled with, you know, any kind of spice that was very difficult to find here. So,
that's certainly one way to both preserve and adapt these recipes that were carried on. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you a little bit about Frieda DeKnight, who I know you're writing a book about, and you know she was a food editor at Ebony Magazine, which you know pretty much everyone is familiar with Ebony. She grew up in the Midwest as well, and she also wrote cookbooks. So, if you could just spend a few minutes telling our listeners about Frieda DeKnight as an African American Midwestern woman, and how she shaped African American food culture and identity through some of her cookbooks.
It was really one basic cookbook, A Date with mm-hmm. a Dish, that became the Ebony cookbook. But it was her one giant piece of work. And the only one that has There are some reproductions now. They're all, but they only the original has this one chapter of amazing recipes that were collected from specific families from the South. But Frida, what I loved about her and what attracted, she knew, my grandmothers both knew her. She would travel, wow, and she was an elegant club woman. And she grew up in Topeka, Kansas. Her father had been a porter who passed away, she was born in Topeka. Her father had been a porter, and she was, according to some, there are different sort of time frames, but when she was about two, and then she and her mother and sister moved to South Dakota. Mm. And that's where some say family friends, others say uncle, and it was her uncle who was from Chicago, was a caterer. And so she moved there and as a young girl would learn from them. But she came from a very, very middle-class family. She integrated everything she ever knew. So I, as a young girl, I identified with her because my sisters and I integrated our schools. And I identified with what it felt like to be the only Black in a white environment. And that's what she had. She integrated in, she was the only Black in her school in South Dakota and then in college and whatever. But what she did, she appreciated so much the, and here, can you imagine in South Dakota, the Southern foods that her uncle catered. And she learned to make those, and those are the dishes that she began appreciating. And then she married a jazz musician. She and traveled, moved to New York. I go when I'm in Manhattan. She's up in Harlem, and I go and stand in front of the apartment. The apartment building's still standing where she used to live.
Wow!
And just to breathe the air and see what she had. But she moved to Manhattan and then traveled to Europe, and would live for months at a time. Well, her husband was a musician. Rene Dunite. And so she would go and spend, so she was able to pick up on all the different nuances of recipes and food and always appreciated her native, our cultural cuisine more than ever, more than any of them.
And did if I am recalling correctly, I think it was her, maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't it Frida Dunite who put forth a cookbook, I think, in the 1940s, basically aiming at getting young African American children into the kitchen? Was that her?
She wrote a book for everybody. It wasn't for children, but it was. She wrote a book in 1948 called "A Date with a Dish," and what she, after all this international exposure and travel and whatever, she the subtitle was "By Us for Us."
There and it is. She
She talks about how this is food by us as Black people for our Black families. At the time, there were lots of books that were caricatures, the Aunt Jemima kind of caricature of Black cooks. And this, she was really underlining the fact that this was by us with a seriousness and with an appreciation for our culture. And it's for us and for us to pass down. And she traveled around the country, and that was her message. She'd speak to women's groups, she'd speak to cultural groups, and she would talk about the importance of us appreciating our recipes and passing them down. One of the things I remember my grandmother wrote down that she had said was that when we skip one generation of not passing it down, the nuances of that recipe are lost forever.
That's so true.
Yes, that's the grandmother saying, okay, smell this. when it gets to just this temperature, or when the bread gets just this puffy, that's when you then deflate it and roll it. You know, those are the things that you really have to each generation pass down.
That is, I think, what so many groups, what regardless of your, you know, ethnic, racial heritage, we all feel that sentiment of culture being passed down through food, and that's exactly what you're describing here.
Right, right. And the one thing that was even made it more important to her, makes it more important to me, is that in many ways, that was all that we had in relationship to what would be passed down. We had lost our names, our religion, our place of birth, our family. We had lost everything we shared as a people. And these recipes that we all, from survival in a strange land, made, you know, based on a lot of times throwaway dishes or based on those kind, were the things that we all shared. And that made it even more important.
Well, that's a beautiful place to end our conversation, Donna. A way that food has retained, it's been the crux of the African-American identity out of, you know, in very difficult circumstances, the one thing that, at least as you're describing it, food being the common denominator of creating a common heritage and narrative for African-Americans across the country, including those that migrated to the Midwest. We'll be right back after a short break.
I'm Ethan Frisch, co-host of Why Food and co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks. We set our partner farmers up to export their own crops for the first time, and they get access to a whole new market here in the U.S., and we get access to spices that other companies can't source. We're honored to work with restaurants including 11 Madison Park, Blue Hill, and Chez Panisse, as well as thousands of home cooks across the country. Visit us at burlapandbarrel.com.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. I want to bring back our last guest, Donna Pierce, to help us connect the African-American community with the Appalachian community and how both came to the Midwest. Donna, I know that oftentimes when we think about African-American migration, we don't often think that Appalachian communities overlap with African-American communities. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that particular community and the foodways it brought into the Midwest.
I was on a panel at Southern Foodways several years ago and introduced the poet, Frank X. Walker. And he has a poetry book. He's a professor now in Kentucky, but he has a poetry book called Afrolacia. And it was the first time I'd heard that. And as I understand it, he is the person who brought that word to us. And it's the idea that we don't, once again, in our books and in our studies, learn about all, of course there were African Americans in the Appalachian regions. And of course, it's part of the, it was part of the culture there, the foodways there, and the migration there. I had a list of some of the things that are shared in terms of foodways, but pickling and the canning, the food is that, my experience that's from migrants from that area would be not as spicy as the food. And it, you know, that comes from the different areas when people migrate. From where my family came from, very, very spicy, hot food, and here not so much. Sometimes I know that there's a big discussion about do Black people eat cornbread with sugar? And very much so, yes, all over the South. But I do know Blacks from Afrolacia, quote, hand quote, that do not. And I know people whose families came from that some of the regions of Kentucky and of the Appalachians who did not add sugar to their cornbread. Molasses, important to baking and important to a lot of glazing of meats and sauerkraut, dried beans, but there's quite a bit of shared culture and food ways, and there's quite a bit of Black people that you see from, it's not the caricature that we learned mm-hmm. in our school books.
Well, that's, I think it's important to note that, and this is again what this show is all about, is exposing folks to things that they may have not recognized or known about. And I know even growing up so close to parts of Appalachia, as the three rivers meet in Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, I didn't necessarily associate Black America with Appalachian America. And so I appreciate you sharing that with me and with our listeners.
I think we're at a time now where we're getting a different standard of inclusion, and we're getting a better understanding of, you know, historical events and the people who shaped them and the people who contributed. So I'm really happy for that.
Our next guest is going to take a deeper dive into Appalachian migration and its surprising impact on Midwestern foodways. Bruce Craig is Professor Emeritus in History at Roosevelt University in Chicago. He is the editor of the Heartland Foodways book series for the University of Illinois Press and is the author of a number of books related to food, including Man Bites Dog, Hot Dog Culture in America. Bruce, we're happy to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for allowing me to speak.
Hey, that's what we're here for, right? We're a radio show. We're all about speaking.
Good, good.
And today we're going to speak about Appalachian culture. Now, I do want to ask you, is it Appalachian or Appalachian to you in your view?
Either. I've heard it both ways. And I myself say Appalachian.
As do I, but I know some say Appalachian, and it's a tomato when it comes to this sort of thing.
Yeah.
But
figured
I'd asked. So yep. That's what we're going to be talking about today: the impact and influence of Appalachian migration and into the Midwest. So, Bruce, maybe we can start off by you giving us some insight into Appalachian culture. Many who came from that region of the country had their own individual immigrant stories from Europe. So what were these specific influences?
Well, Appalachian means the hill and mountain country to the west of the original coastal settlements in the United States by Europeans. So they're varied, the people who moved into the backcountry. But typically, when we think of Appalachians, we think of Scotch-Irish and Irish and settlers from New England who moved down there. Mm-hmm. For example, Abraham Lincoln's family, which originated in Massachusetts and then moved down to Virginia, and then, like Abraham Lincoln's father, Kentucky, Indiana, Illinois. So it's varied. But
right.
I think in terms of folk culture, and you'll need to talk to the folklorists about this, we tend
sure.
to think of the North British Scotch-Irish.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of food did these groups bring, or as far as their specific original immigrant culture and how that influenced Appalachian food?
Right. Well, as people moved into the backcountry, they found food possibilities, raising food more difficult because they're in mountains and heavily wooded areas. And if you think about what the late 18th and 19th centuries were, they had to cut wood, cut forests, and then plant their fields. So what planted best was corn, and what they could raise most easily were pigs. So the culture is generally associated with what we call hog and hominy culture. Now, that's Southern in general, but I think Appalachian food is very much like that. Plus, a lot of wild foods. One of the classic dishes is called Brunswick stew, and that's called
right.
the burgoo to the west, and There are other names for it. Smith and Over is another one. And that comes from the hunting culture that you'd find in the upcountry in these wooded areas. And mm-hmm. Brunswick stew typically has squirrel in it, along with anything else you could find. Yeah. So,
right,
so that's the kind of food you'll find. Biscuits, cornbread, corn-based products, hominy, of course, and lots of pigs.
Well, so we have a good idea of kind of the origin story, maybe, at least ethnically from an immigrant standpoint of, you know, where the roots of those that were in Appalachia originate. You've given us a little bit of a taste of what we could find in Appalachian food. We're going to dig into that deeper in a second. But before we get there, I'm curious for you to talk a little bit about how and why and when these individuals started leaving Appalachia and coming into the Midwest.
Yeah. Well, they're always looking for land. The story of America is land hunger.
And indeed.
Yes. And what they did to the land, and often just catastrophic effects. That's an ongoing thing, by the way, with the Midwest flooding and lots of problems with climate change. So they're looking for better land. A good example is Abraham Lincoln's family. His father moved to Kentucky, where they had great difficulty with land ownership and the documentation of land, who owned it and what. It was complete chaos. Mm. He was so disgusted, plus he didn't like slavery, that he moved to Indiana. So, and he cut the forest and built a little log cabin. And then Heard didn't do very well. And then heard that the land in Illinois, central Illinois, was much better. It was the prairie. And he moved there and eventually settled in a place called Coles County, which is in central Illinois. So that's why people moved. It's why the Midwest was settled. People from the New England states, New York, where the land was getting worse, where you couldn't make a profit from raising wheat, which is the prime grain that they wanted, they moved west. And as when the Midwest opened after the Revolutionary War, that's when people began flooding down there and in waves, on and on. I should mention that newer immigrants, found that the Midwest, or heard that the Midwest was really rich land. And in particular, Germans, there's a heavy German influence in the early Midwest, which remains in food waste to this day.
Sure, we're gonna talk to somebody explicitly about German and Germanic influences on a different episode. But I do know, I think this is important in this context as well, though, to talk a little bit, I think, about the German triangle. Is that where you're going with this?
Well, yeah, I was going to talk about the differences between German farmers and the native. I put that in parenthesis, native, because they're not Native Americans. English and Anglo, Scotch-Irish.
That's important. That's important to this conversation because, as you mentioned, those are the, you know, ethnic groups, so to speak, the immigrant groups that, you know, were most frequently associated with the Appalachian communities that we're talking about. So I'm all ears.
Yeah. Well, they moved through down the river valleys, Germans, and so did the people from Appalachia. So let me start with the migration route. The Ohio Valley was the highway by which people came from the backcountry in Appalachia down into the Midwest. So the Midwest, states like Indiana and Illinois, were settled from the bottom up at first. That's where most of the population was. And it's where the National Road, which was begun early on in the 19th century, it's now called Route 40, ran right through the middle of central Illinois over to Missouri. So it's because there was a lot of commerce running down from Pittsburgh down through what you could think of as Appalachia, West Virginia and Western Virginia and such, and Kentucky, and down to New Orleans. So that's the route they took. And the land was fertile on either side. Southern Ohio was settled that way. Places like Marietta, Ohio, which became an important
quadruple.
And then Cincinnati, which is an early and the leading meat-producing city in America before Chicago, and a whole lot of others moved down that way. Germans came down that route also, and these were early Germans in the late 18th century. The big German migration began around 1850, and they could take either the Ohio or the other overland routes, which since northern part of the Midwest was now being settled, along the Great Lakes and other inland routes. And they settled in the interior of the Midwest in very great numbers.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. And so you're talking a little bit about how these communities got there and their agricultural practices as well. And so I want to come back to Appalachian foods specifically. And you mentioned vergou and Brunswick stew and these sort of things, but can you maybe give us a few more examples of maybe iconic dishes that are associated with Appalachian food?
Well, biscuits, biscuits and red eye gravy. If this sounds southern to you,
what is red eye gravy?
Red eye gravy is from pork, the drippings for pork chops. It it's more pork than beef. Salt pork, for example.
Right, going back directly to what you were saying before about the ability for them to raise hogs in particular.
Yeah, because pigs are so smart and adaptable, they can live anywhere. And typically, you would just allow your pigs to forage in the woods around your settlement and then harvest them mm-hmm. in December, which is the standard slaughter time. And then preserve lots of it over the winter. This, in fact, was done until the middle of the last century, into the 1950s, and I know families who did it, and occasionally you'll find people who still do. But that was what farm life was like. Pig slaughter in December, and you put up meat, you make sausages, you put them in crocks, cover them with lard, and they'll keep over the winter. Also smoked hams. Virginia is famous for those, as you know. But that was done. It was done everywhere, and so they ate everything: lard, lard for baking, and then frying lard was common. In fact, lard is the shortening and grease, cooking grease of choice in the South. In fact, all over America, but especially the South and Appalachia, they ate. And ate a lot of wild game. For example, raccoon and possum were common and still are. In the early days when there were still bison left, venison for meats, a lot of wild berries and other plants, Jerusalem artichokes, for example, dandelion greens, and mushrooms naturally, but that culture of gathering foods still exists to some degree in rural America, in the rural parts of Illinois, and certainly in Appalachia. And there are just a great number. There are a great number of wild plants that they ate.
Right. Well, it sounds like the Appalachian foodways that ultimately were transferred into the Midwest were very informed by, really making the most of and being resourceful with what's potentially at hand, and then also making sure that there was not waste, I mean, it sounds like they're really utilizing everything that they can, you know, get their hands on, and they're not going to waste any aspect of something that may be able to be consumed.
Correct.
And because of, you know, frankly, the economic situation, you know, in Appalachia, and I'm sure that also informed their views as Appalachians migrated west for land, but also, you know, part of that being hopeful for newer economic opportunity too.
Yes, exactly. And there's a bifurcation of foodways between Northerners and people who, and moneyed people who were better, richer farmers, and the very poor. And that remained until World War II. In fact, it still remains for some degree, as you know, the difference between what poor folks eat and what the people with money eat. So the poor, I'm speaking to you from Southern Illinois, which is where the Southern foodways, the Appalachian foodways, and Northern foodways meet. It's the Mid-South, really. And the poor people down here ate a lot of catfish and made their living by getting catfish out of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers, which is where we are in a kind of a basin between the two of them. And that's common everywhere as Appalachian people spread out toward the west. So you're right. Preserving as much food as possible. Many of them are hungry. In hard times, they were then, and this still exists now.
Right. Very, very interesting. And this is why I'm so fascinated and wanted to make sure that, you know, we covered an area that maybe not a lot of people talk about, not only domestic migration and its impacts on, you know, sort of the evolution of regional foodways across the United States, but particularly Appalachian culture and food, which, you know, is oftentimes overlooked. But I want to ask you one final question, because I know in some of our previous conversations, you told me about a cookbook that actually focused on this Appalachian food in part of the Midwest. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that cookbook and what we could find in it if we could get our hands on it.
Right. Well, there was the only historic cookbook for that I know of in this part of the country, and I'm talking again about Southern Illinois, which is really interesting, is written by Helen Walker Linsenmeyer, and it was published in 1976 and republished, called Cooking Plain, Illinois Country Style, by Southern Illinois University Press. It's not expensive. You can get it online. I did a new edition of it and put a foreword in. And this is kind of a family history of the Walker family in Southern Illinois, which is a mixture of Appalachian, Anglo, and German. So in it, you'll find fried squirrel, squirrel stew, lots of wild greens and what to make of them, but also with Lebkuchen and Pfeffernuss.
What are either of those things?
Well, there, wherever you find German communities, and there are plenty of them around here, we're near St. Louis, and there are German settlements, which are still pretty German. Whenever you look at their cookbooks, those are two paradigmatic foods that you'll find, baked goods. Lebkuchen, which is rolled out and put in a press, it's a cookie, and Pfeffernuss, which is a kind of cookie also, both made for holidays, and they're there. And so they're in Helen Walker Linsenmeyer's book as well. This is a fascinating book, and I urge readers to have a look at it. She was a very fine cookbook writer. If you want a snapshot of what a not often looked at part of the country looks like.
Well, that's exactly what we're trying to do on this show, is bring, you know, a different narrative, a different perspective, and expose listeners to things that they may have not necessarily thought about, heard about, read about, or listened about, in another context. So, Bruce Craig, I'm very thankful for you joining us today and sharing your insights and your expertise on this little known area of Appalachian foodways in the Midwest. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.